Hayden leans forward and kisses my cheek.
I'll walk you back to your car,
he says, starting to stand. You mean you'll carry me? I tease. I hear there are snakes around here. 19. Margaret answers her own door on Saturday morning, and I'm so caught off guard that for 3 seconds after she greets me, I just stare. Where's Jody? I finally ask when I step inside and slip my shoes off. Day off, Margaret says shortly, and leads me down the hallway.
Too hot to be outside today. Mind if we sit in the living room?
Works for me, I tell her. We stop by the kitchen first, and she shakes a box of colorful frozen macarons onto a plate.
Coffee? Tea?
Coffee, I say, but I can get it myself. She waves me toward the pot, and I pour myself a mug and find the sugar in a jar beneath the cupboard. You want one? I ask.
Already got mine waiting in there, she tells me,
and I follow her back to the room where we first met. It's so hot out today that the air conditioning can't keep up. The air feels stiff and damp. Even for me, it's a bit much. Just not enough to keep me from drinking hot coffee. I must wince when I taste it, because Margaret laughs.
All right. I don't usually make the coffee.
It's not that bad, I say. I try another gulp. My reaction makes her start laughing again, and it's contagious. As I rein my giggles in, I set my mug aside and take out my recorder. So today's the day.
What day is that?
Her silver brows leap upward, but there's something in her expression that tells me it's an act, that she's actually just as excited for today's interview as I am. The day it becomes your story, I say, hitting the button to start recording and setting the device on the table between us. She flicks a hand over her shoulder, an unconvincing pish-posh.
I told you, it's all my story. When you come from a family like mine, you're a part of a whole, like one square in a quilt. Anytime you try to pull in a particular direction, there are hundreds of other squares to resist, to pull you back.
I get that, I say. But today, try to ignore those squares. I want to know what it was like to be you. She smiles wide.
For a time, she says. It was pure magic.
The story. Their version. What it must be like to be raised in a castle. Her version.
What's it like to be raised in a castle? What's it like to have everything you want before you've asked for it? What's it like to have your food plated by a chef when you're still a toddler?
What's it like to have the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus perform at your 5th birthday? To have snow blown in on the hill behind your house in time for Christmas and to spend all summer wandering through your private orange groves and playing hide-and-seek in the hedge maze or the chapel or the slough of Greek follies? To grow up with horses and dogs, swans and zebras and peacocks all wandering past your window, bonded enough to you to eat straight from your hand? What's it like to break your arm sliding down a grand staircase's banister and take your family's helicopter to the hospital? To live inside a 10-foot stone wall so far from your front door that anything beyond it might as well be a different world? What's it like when your father loves your mother madly, when he fills the breakfast room, because there is a room just for breakfast, with daisies, potted, not cut, on her birthday, and she rolls her eyes but laughs too, because she doesn't have an ounce of his whimsy, but she understands the hundreds of ways her husband tries, again and again, to say something along the lines of "I love you." When they were younger, Margaret and her sister Laura, life came in flickers of yellow gold. Warmth, that's what she remembers. Laughter. Her mother blowing raspberries on her stomach. Her father trying, and failing, to make daisy chains for his girls to wear. Her cousin Ruth braiding her hair. Her aunt Francine taking her horseback riding. Strolling with great aunt Gigi down the perfume aisles in the glossy department stores along 7th Street. Grandmother Rosalind reading to her in the library, Margaret sitting in her lap and toying with the string of pearls that lay against Rosalind's cashmere sweater while her grandfather Gerald smoked an overpriced cigar over by the window. She remembers kissing her parents goodnight before they left for premieres, balls, galas, and loving the smell of her mother's soap, the oh-so-rare appearance of a muted mauve paint on her lips. She remembers sneaking out of bed to meet Laura in the tent strung up in their playroom, because there was a room just for playing, and staying up all night, giggling and whispering and shining flashlights on their picture books. There's one day in particular she remembers best, a Sunday in late summer, before the heat had broken, when she spent the whole day with her parents and her sister in the ornately tiled outdoor pool, not to be confused with the indoor pool. She remembers practicing diving with her mother. She remembers her father tossing her up, 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 then catching her right before she crashed against the surface. And holding her little sister's hand, running as fast as they could from the edge of the pool, convinced that if only they were fast enough, worked hard enough, they could sail right across the surface of the water without sinking. She still thinks about this day a lot, as a kind of before picture. The last golden day. After that, the world turned blue, as if when she dove under the surface of the water, the cool tones had washed across her eyes and never left. After that, Margaret's memories are different. Fights, sometimes screamed and other times whispered. Slammed doors, bits of jagged blue sentences sneaking through doors and walls. Do you even care that you're a mother? Do you even love them? Out again until all hours so you can do whatever you want, but I should be here. Not the person I married, not even close. If you hate your life so much, why are you even still? She remembers her grandmother Rosalind introducing her and Laura to their new nanny and feeling so sure it was all a punishment if she could only figure out for what she had done wrong. She was always getting herself into trouble in the form of scraped knees, muddy tracks across rugs and broken vases. It could have been anything. She remembers quiet meals at the dinner table. One of the tables was exclusively for dinner, with the whole family, and then one day the small table moved into the playroom, and all her and her sister's meals taken there, apart from the others. She'd go days sometimes without seeing her parents, and worse still, somehow, were the nights they came in one at a time to say their goodnights, looking tired or angry or pained. What is it like when all of your clothes were made to fit your body, your shoes resoled without your asking, your hairdresser waiting for you on the veranda once a month? What is it like to cry when your favorite swan dies and to have your grandfather look you in the eye and say, "Your father was supposed to have a son. Who's going to look after all of this when I'm gone?" What's it like to roller skate in the ballroom with your sister? Or to read a book about a pony and wake up the next morning to find one wearing a big velvet bow in the marble foyer and to love it so much you name it after the swan you lost and tell yourself that maybe, somehow, it is the swan come back from beyond the grave to care for you. Because while everyone around you takes care of you, you aren't really sure that any of them care about you. When you fall and scrape your knee, there's a mad rush for gauze and rubbing alcohol, but when you weep over the delicate, broken neck of a bird, you're given a lollipop. When you want something you have no idea how to ask for and no clue whether it even exists. What do you do when you live in a world that was built around you, and so you find yourself trapped, like one sentence in a myth, one brick in a wall? When you're built into the fabric of a place, and that place was built to keep everyone out. What's it like to feel yourself alone in the world? 20. They did their best, Margaret says. The truth is, I think all my mother ever really wanted was to make her art, and I think all my father ever wanted was to be my mother's husband. When either of them felt like those things were being challenged, well, they never really learned to compromise. Not until they split up. I've read some old articles, I say, about the divorce. She winces, and I can guess why.
The tabloids and Dove Franklin had all positioned Bernie Ives as an uptight nag who'd never been worthy of the rich, charming, handsome Freddie Ives. "I remember my grandmother, Rosalind, trying to convince them to stay married," she says. "She loved my mother, and she knew the world would be unkind to her, or less kind than it already was. But my parents weren't ever invested in controlling the narrative the way my grandparents had been. And besides that, as long as I've been alive, there was a strict rule against any tabloids in the house. Laura and I were young and secluded enough not to be exposed to the worst of it, but I would occasionally hear Rosalind talking about it with my Aunt Francine and Great Aunt Gigi. She convinced my parents to take us up to the mountains, to stay at..." She considers for a second, like the name is just barely evading her. "The Nicolette. One last long weekend to remind them what they were giving up." "How'd it go?" I ask. "It was bliss," she says. "And then we got home, and the next morning they sat us down in Laura's room and told us Mom was moving out. Years later, she told me she wanted to leave while she still loved him. For us. I think it broke her heart to do it, though. I'm not sure she ever got over it, even after she remarried." I stay quiet, half expecting her to clam up again, but she doesn't. "You know, my mother was ahead of her time, the kind of woman who wanted to have it all," she says. "She knew she deserved it, too. But the problem is, once you love someone, you can't have it all anymore. Love comes with sacrifice, that's how it works. Lawrence left his little sister in Dillon Springs thinking he could help her, and instead he never saw her again. Gerald loved Nina, but he had to give her up to take care of Ruth. Rosalind loved Gerald, but she had to accept his secret as her own, had to believe the story until it was true."
"You mean about Ruth?" I ask. "You think your grandmother knew the truth? That Ruth was her husband's daughter, not Gigi's?" Margaret nods.
"She never said, but I'm sure of it. She loved her family too much to cause a scandal by bringing it up, and besides that, I think she came to genuinely love Ruth. Everyone who ever met her did. She had a spark. Anyway, my parents' divorce was highly publicized, and it didn't help that my father's reaction to losing the love of his life was to throw himself back into public womanizing with a vengeance."
"The playboy and the shrew part ways," I remember one article declaring.
"We barely saw our mother that first year they were divorced, but we saw even less of him. It was an incredibly lonely time."
"When did things thaw out between them?" I ask. "How, after all that?"
"My mother had a movie release," Margaret says simply. "And my father hadn't missed a single one since they'd met. So he went, by himself, the same way he had done years earlier. He couldn't keep being her husband, but he couldn't stop being her fan."
I feel myself smile, even as my chest aches for her. She shakes her head as if dispelling a cloud of dust.
"Anyway, he sent her potted daisies the next day. She called him. They had one short, civil conversation. But a couple of weeks later, something funny happened. I don't remember what, though I'm sure she told me at some point, and she wanted to tell him. So she called him. Soon they were talking every day, going on walks every once in a while. She started coming by for dinners occasionally. We had her over for Christmas. Eventually, we were happy again, even if things were never the same."
"You were 15 when she married Roy?" I say, checking my notes.
"That's right," she says. "And Dad married Linda a year later, but they split up when I was 21.
"And after that," I say, trying to sound as even and non-judgmental as possible.
"Carol, for about 6 years," she says. "Does that sound right?"
"It does," I agree. "Were you close with either of them?"
"Close enough," she says. "It was a big house, and it wasn't uncommon for Great Aunt Gigi's latest beau to be hanging around, too. We'd see everyone for dinners, but if anything, Dad's wives after Mom were like distant cousins. We knew each other, but we didn't spend much time together."
"And Roy?" I ask.
"We loved Roy," she says. "Laura and I both. He was a good man, and he let us be a family. He did what our father couldn't. And what was that? I ask. Her narrow shoulders hitch upward. He shared her. She pauses for a long moment, and I watch her weigh her next words, deciding whether she can trust me with them. I don't rush forward to comfort or to cajole. The next couple of weeks are likely going to feel a lot harder for her than the first two, and as eager as I am to prove myself, I can't force her to be ready.
Roy and my mother were married for 30 years, you know, she says.
I do, I confirm, until he died.
Afterward,
she pauses again, still unsure. I reach forward and turn off the recorder, stopping the one on my phone as well.
She loved him,
she says, a sideways lurch in the conversation, or perhaps a detour that will lead us to the same place.
She loved him, and he loved us, and I think she appreciated him every day of their life together. Dad went first, from liver failure, and then a few years after that, Roy died from heart disease. Mom had him buried in the family cemetery because Roy was family.
Her lips quiver.
After his funeral, after everyone had left but Mom and me, she went over to my dad's headstone, and she started weeping. You know, she'd held it together all that time. She was never an easy crack, my mother, but she lost it, slumped down at his headstone and coiled her arms around it. And she said something I won't ever forget, something I still hear in her voice if I try, like I'm replaying it on film. Why couldn't it have been you? Why couldn't you be who you were supposed to be?
Shivers crawl down my arms, and my chest feels too small for my beating heart. What do you make of that?
I don't make anything of it, she murmurs. I know exactly what she meant.
She sets her mug down.
He was the love of her life, and he let the world make him too small for her. The world Freddie Ives lived in was built around him. There wasn't room for her.
I swallow and nod. What do you think he should have done? She turns the full force of those shining blue eyes on me.
For the one you love? Anything. You unmake the world and build a new one. You do anything to give them what they need.
You're strangely quiet,
Hayden says. Hmm? I look up from the road, nearly startling at the sight of him hunched in the passenger seat of my slightly too small rental car.
Are you regretting this?
He asks.
It's not too late to turn around.
No, I say. No, that's not what this is about. On my next glance, I see his skepticism. It's about work, I say, as vaguely and innocuously as possible. His features tighten, and he turns his gaze forward again. Sorry, I say. I know we can't talk about it. There's a long silence before he says,
We can't talk about her, but we can talk about you, if there's a way to do that without...
He trails off, but I know what he's saying. The problem is, I'm not sure there is a way to separate the two, what Margaret's saying and how I'm feeling. It's all braided tightly together. The thing that's gripping me right now, the part of Margaret's and my last conversation that I can't shake, isn't just her sadness, her melancholy, her air of loneliness, or even the way the poised, confident octogenarian had become almost childlike in front of me, but the fact that for the first time, I felt sure she was telling me the truth. The whole truth, not a modified version with select bits and pieces tweaked or dodged. It's interesting how this part of her family's history, the part most firmly planted in her point of view, is also the most honest. It's nearly the opposite of what that famous quote suggests. There might be three versions of any story, but does that mean that hers is any less true? Maybe truth is less about a compromise of conflicting viewpoints and more about an integration of them. The thought discomfits me. I've always wanted to make my interview subjects feel seen and heard, but there's also been a comfort in believing I'm nothing more than a conduit, a funnel, for the truth to pour through,
a sieve catching and dispelling any unnecessary bits. It changes things to think that maybe everything is necessary. Maybe truth can't be whittled out of a pile of research, but instead has to be built from all of it. No spare pieces left behind, absolutely nothing discarded. And if that's the case, how can I possibly succeed at this job or any other? From the passenger seat, Hayden sighs and scrubs a hand over his face.
I wish I could help you.
I'm okay, really, I promise him. I guess I'm just... Do you ever doubt the job? One inky eyebrow curves up.
Doubt the job? How so?
I shake my head. I don't know. Forget I said anything. There's a long pause, no sound but the highway whirring under our tires as the sun beats down on the glass and the kudzu-covered trees whip past us on either side of the road.
I haven't seen you like this before,
he says with a small, tight frown. What, mopey? I say. It doesn't happen much.
Is it because you're going to see your mother?
He asks. My stomach clenches and relaxes. I don't know, I admit. Maybe. It hadn't occurred to me, but it feels true. When I'm with my mom and sister, no matter how many times I promise myself I'll handle things differently, I always catch myself sliding into the defensive when it comes to my job, trying to legitimize it in their eyes. It's not like she's rude about my work, I clarify. She really isn't. It's more just what she doesn't say.
That she's proud of you?
He guesses. My cheeks flame. I'm 33. Why do I care?
Everyone cares,
he says. I give him a look.
Fine,
he says.
The vast majority of people care.
When do you think you stop? I ask. When you're 40? When they die? I shoot him a teasing look. When you win a Pulitzer? He scoffs quietly.
No, not then. Because then, suddenly, they're incredibly proud. But they're proud of the accomplishment, not of the work. So you feel like you have to keep accomplishing instead of just creating. It affirms the idea that the value in what you do is how people react to it, and not just in the making of it. I've written stuff I'm really proud of that hardly anyone read. I've written stuff I'm proud of that no one liked. That doesn't mean it didn't deserve to be written.
Now I'm genuinely smiling, my mood lifting almost instantly. That's a nice thought. His huge shoulders lift in a shrug.
It's true. How many of your favorite shows got canceled? How many of the best albums barely sold when they came out? I mean, It's a Wonderful Life was a box office flop in its time. If everyone who worked on that movie had known, could see how things were going to pan out in the short term, would they have even bothered to make it? And then the world would have lost out on something beautiful. Just because something doesn't make money or win awards doesn't mean it doesn't have value or doesn't deserve to exist. The job is alchemy. You take a hunk of rock and you try to turn it into gold, and the gold isn't even really the point.
Right, because the goal is immortality, I joke.
It's permanence,
he says.
Not like having your name on the side of a fucking airplane or a skyscraper or some shit like that, but bringing something intangible into the world that can live on without you. Something bigger than the person who made it. And even then, the goal is secondary to the process. The process is for us. It changes us in ways that can't be measured. At least, that's what I've always thought.
My grin is getting bigger by the second.
What?
He says, an edge of, oh, here we go, to his voice. Nothing, I say. I just didn't expect you to be so...
whimsical,
he says, reticent. Optimistic, I correct him. His brow furrows, his expression somewhat dour, but I'm not falling for it anymore. Below that stony face and beneath that equally stony chest, there's a soft, thrumming, hopeful heart. He clears his throat.
Are you sure your mom's okay with me coming?
She's excited, I tell him. It's a classic example of the slippery nature of truth. Did my mother say she was excited when I told her I was bringing a friend? No, she absolutely did not. She said, and this is a direct quote, okay. But is she excited? Certainly. There are two places my mother is most alive, most herself. The first is in her garden, with mud up to her shins and Dad's hideous wide-brimmed hat atop her head, the chin strap tight and her cheeks red from digging. The other place is more of a state of being. When she's caring for visitors, when she can be a good steward of her little plot of land, she's happy.
Excited,
Hayden repeats to himself.
Not sure I can live up to that.
Just eat whatever she puts in front of you and she'll be happy, I say, and offer to help with the dishes. His knee jogs up and down, his jaw stern as he gazes out the window. Are you nervous? I ask.
I don't know,
he says. Then,
no. Should I be?
Definitely not, I say. She's easy. Another example of the amorphous nature of the truth. She really is easy. Simultaneously, there are knots in my stomach. Hayden nods, but doesn't say anything else. I turn on the radio, and Gladys Knight and the Pips' midnight train to Georgia fills the car. The sun is setting by the time we pull into the long driveway to the single-story home where I grew up. I try, as always, to see it how an outsider must, and as always, I fail. This place is just home to me, the same way the opulent House of Ives was to Margaret. There's a chicken coop built out of repurposed boards and plywood, and at least one kitchen cupboard Dad had found years ago on a neighbor's curb after a renovation, and a little fenced-in area surrounding it for the birds to wander as they so choose. There's a shed that's similarly haphazard in appearance, and I know, sturdy in construction. Along the edge of the property on our right, a split-rail fence, repaired piecemeal as needed, runs through overgrown grass. A couple of blue rain barrels gathered together in a row, while to our left, garden beds in various states of growth spread out, a thicket of peach trees beyond the shed, the coop, the huge compost bins, and the outhouse Audrey and I helped Dad build around his and Mom's prized possession, slash the bane of our adolescent existence, the composting toilet. The house itself appears to slightly lean, but that's only because of the strange grade of the ground. The paint on the shutters is peeling off in chunks, but the roof is fairly new, covered in solar panels.
Wow,
Hayden says. An impressed wow, I think, and not a mortified one. I can't help but feel like he just passed a test, albeit one I hadn't meant to set up. As we rumble closer, I see Mom unfold from where she was crouched in the garden. Just as I predicted, Dad's green khaki hat sits snug against her head, the chin strap all the way tightened, her worn-out and too large overalls stuffed into her wellies, and her bare arms disappearing at the elbow into her thick green gloves. She waves one arm over her head as I pull up, squinting against the light.
Oh,
Hayden says beside me.
She's...
I save him the trouble of finishing the sentence. Beautiful, yeah. I shoot him a teasing look as I put the car in park. Don't act so surprised, or I might finally start taking things personally.
It's not like that,
he says. I know, I promise. But the truth, the other version of it, is that I'm feeling a little raw and vulnerable. My mom raised Audrey and me not to care about appearances. She and Dad never talked about how we looked, and I know why she did it. And for my sister, I think it even worked. But the truth is, without makeup and hair dye and nice clothes, my mom has always been stunningly pretty. And my sister looks just like her. Big green eyes, gold hair, little pointed chin, petite with curves. I've always taken more after Dad. Tall, lanky, with only the fairest strawberry undertone to my generally mousy hair. Maybe it's easier to say looks don't matter when you look like Hollywood's version of a hard-working, outdoorsy woman with a heart of gold. Mom peels her gloves off as she comes toward us, and I unlock the doors and get out. How was the trip? She asks, giving me a firm hug and one quick pat on the back before pulling away and wiping sweat from her brow with the back of her wrist. Great! I pop open the back door to grab my bag, while Hayden does the same on the other side of the car. This is my friend Hayden. Mom flashes a naturally perfect, if slightly yellowed, smile across the top of the car. Nice to meet you, she says, then adds simply, Angela.
Nice to meet you too.
Hayden hoists his duffel bag out of the back seat and comes around to shake her hand.
Oh, we're huggers, she says, bypassing the hand and going straight for the kill, the same kind of firm grip and single hit between his shoulder blades, over before it even began.
Thanks so much for having me, he says as they separate.
Oh, it's nothing. She flicks the glove in her hand. I'm still not used to cooking for one, honestly, so this is better. Come on in and Alice will get you settled while I clean myself up. What are you working on? I ask as we follow her to the front door.
Well, mostly the strawberries and peaches, of course, she says.
What about the beans and peas? I ask. Are they ready yet? She nods.
Yep, and the cucumbers this year are incredible. I mean, you wouldn't believe. Well, you will believe. Figured we'd have them in a salad tonight.
She kicks open the squeaky screen door. The door behind it is never shut, and steps aside to let us pass. Inside, Mom and I kick off our shoes, and Hayden follows our lead. Luckily, he's not any more of a sandals person than he is a shorts person, so he's wearing socks, which I didn't think to warn him is a bit of a necessity in our house. Even though we're a no-shoes-inside family, when you spend as much time outside as Angela Scott, the dirt finds its way into the old floorboards. I watch him scan the entryway, the tidy rows of boots, clogs, and sandals coated in varying degrees of dried mud, the reusable grocery bags and totes dangling from the hooks drilled into the wall over them, the pencil marks where Dad documented Audrey's and my growth spurts on the door jamb on the left, which leads into a dining room that's long been treated more as an extended pantry.
You want to show Hayden to his room?
Mom asks me, draping her gloves across the mouth of a bucket sitting in the corner. Sure, I say. I'll meet you in the kitchen after you shower?
Sounds like a plan.
She leans in and plants a firm kiss on my forehead.
Glad you're here, kid, she says.
Me too, I say. The truth and not the truth. Then she pats my shoulder and ambles down the hall toward her bedroom. When I face Hayden again, he's leaning in to study the Polaroid pinned to the wall beside the front door. Mom and Dad, back in the 70s, standing in front of a newer and less rambling version of this house, their arms wrapped around each other, both proudly beaming, the day they moved in. Hayden feels my eyes and looks over to me.
You lived here all your life.
I did, yeah, I say.
You must miss it, he says.
Sometimes, I admit. Come on, I'll show you where you're staying. 21. The untrained eye might think this is a guest room, or that even if it was Audrey's room at one time, it's long since been emptied out and converted to the sparse little office with the fold-down Murphy bed that Hayden and I are standing before. The untrained eye would be wrong. This is exactly what Audrey's room looked like even when we were in high school. A desk, a dresser, a filing cabinet, a bed that pushes up to the wall to make room for anything other than sitting on the bed. Hayden catches me smiling.
What?
I begin. Don't fit here. He frowns at this.
I grew up somewhere pretty rural, remember?
No, I mean you literally don't fit, I explain. You make this room seem comically small, or I don't know, maybe it makes you look cartoonishly large.
Oh.
He cracks a faint smile too, looks up, not very far, to the ceiling, and then lets his gaze sweep around the room before settling on me again. In my chest, it feels like a latch clicking into place when our eyes meet.
Are you used to having tiny guests?
He asks. This was Audrey's room, I explain. She's always been a minimalist.
What about you?
He asks. Oh, I'm across the hall, I say. Wanna see?
Of course,
he says, following me over to it. It's just as small, but nowhere near as sparse. I used to love it, but now it makes me feel vaguely panicky how full I packed the walls with photos, magazine clippings, notes my sister and I had written back and forth between classes, games of MASH we'd played on notebook paper, trying to predict our futures and pairing ourselves up with our crushes du jour. Like Audrey's bed, mine is covered in a quilt Mom made from repurposed fabric. But unlike the light, breezy colors Audrey had selected, mine is a disgusting blend of neons. This poor quilt, I say. a victim of 2001 trends like so many of us.
I've never seen anything like it,
he agrees. Oh, there's a reason for that, I say, walking over and pointing to one of the magazine pages pinned to the wall. An old Limited 2 catalog, an advertisement for their room decor, wherein everything is sparkly, inflatable, or covered in highlighter green and pink fur. This is what I wanted, I wave toward the quilt, devolving into laughter. And this is my poor mother trying to humor me.
Looking at it is giving me a migraine,
he says, dead serious. I chortle, flip the top back to expose the other side, a sensible light purple with tiny white flowers. Mom trying to ensure maximum usage beyond the length of time it would take me to get sick of the other side.
What's this?
Hayden asks, picking up a leather-bound book that rests atop one of the stacks of books that line the top of my old bookshelf. On the front, embossed, is The Scots, A History. A present from my sister when we were in college, I say, going to stand beside him as he flips it open. It's just this service that will bind a story for you. I had all of these old photographs and journal entries from when we were kids, so... He flips slowly through the first couple of pages, gets to an old shot I took of Audrey crouched atop the compost toilet, fully dressed, not using it, the day we helped Dad build it. She's wearing his wide-brimmed hat and making a funny face.
Wow,
he says.
An outhouse.
Oh, yes, I say. This is our family's opus.
So I see.
He deadpans, turning the page. There I am, out of focus, because Audrey took this one, thus it's one of the very few shots of me in the book, lying on my back in a garden bed, spread out like a starfish in denim overalls like the ones Mom was wearing earlier. A mini bouquet of purple and orange wildflowers tucked behind my ear. I look beatific under the sun. I can feel the humidity of that day on my skin, smell the grass baking, and catch the subtle buzz of the bumblebees bobbing around. Behind me, crouched in front of the garden bed with his back to us as he digs, Dad is visible, just his lower half. Seeing it jogs something loose, the sound of Cosmo Sinclair's signature vibrato crackling out from the old boombox Dad used while he worked, that velvety smooth voice singing about a woman who moved around with the light of the sun inside her, making everything better, warmer, brighter.
You look so happy.
Hayden says, snapping me back to the present. I was. I pass the book to him. I am.
Mind if I borrow this after dinner?
Hayden asks, then, teasing.
Might like to do some light reading.
Oh, that's not light, I say, as he sets the book on the shelf. This is a dense academic doorstop. You're going to want to take notes, have little colorful paper tabs to mark the sections you want to come back to. Actually, now that I think of it, there should be some highlighters in Audrey's debt. He pulls me into a hug abruptly, like he couldn't resist, his face nestling into my shoulder. My stomach swoops up into my throat, trilling like a hummingbird. I loop my arms around his neck and lean back to peek into his face when he lifts it. Were you trying to shut me up again?
No,
he says, shaking his head once. No other explanation, and if there was one, I'm fairly confident he'd give it, which means that he just wanted to do that. Which thrills me, makes me feel weightless and jittery, like that first second of a roller coaster drop. I can't remember the last time I had a crush like this, not one that merely aches the way I'd felt about Theo the first few months, that painful yet addictive feeling of wanting something that is being very intentionally withheld from you. This is the other kind, the dopamine hit of proof, evidence, facts that add up to the knowledge that maybe the person whose very presence excites you is also excited by your presence, that I think he likes me back feeling. Still, I can't resist the impulse to double check. You regret coming yet? I'm expecting something jokey or deadpan. Instead, he just says again, simply,
no.
I let my arms tighten. His hands move to loosely circle my wrists. It's strange how being here has instantly changed the boundaries between us, made everything feel more relaxed, not just natural, but inevitable. How would you feel about a walk? I ask.
Good,
he says. We drop our stuff and go outside into the fading light, meandering down the driveway. At the corner of the country road the house sits on, his hand finds mine. We lace our fingers together and keep walking, kicking up dust, churning up sweat. From the outside, we probably look picturesque and peaceful. Inside, my heart feels like it's riding along the top of a very active geyser. That's the first time it occurs to me. I'm falling in love with him. Maybe it should scare me. It doesn't. I never want it to stop. In the crowded little kitchen, Mom drops a bundle of still dirt-smeared carrots on the counter for me to chop, then goes to fill a pot with water. While she pops it on the stove, I connect to Dad's old Bluetooth speaker and start up a playlist. Cosmo Sinclair's Say You Will Be Mine croons out between us. In my peripheral, I catch her twitch in surprise. It strikes me that Dad was the one to put on their cooking soundtrack, largely because Mom always enters a kind of cooking trance that renders conversation with her nearly impossible. For all I know, she's been cooking in silence these last 2 years. The thought makes me sad. Wordlessly, she fishes a canister of noodles from the pantry and shakes some into the boiling pot.
How can I help?
Hayden's voice rolls over me as he steps into the room, freshly showered and dressed in a worn Purdue sweatshirt and black sweats. He looks so clean and cozy that suddenly I want nothing more than to nestle up in him, the human equivalent of a comfy bed after a long day. My face must betray this, because he's looking at me like, what am I missing? You can help Alice peel the carrots if you want, Mom says over her shoulder. I hand him the peeler and grab a knife from the block before rinsing the carrots. He peels and I cut them on the diagonal, tossing them in a bowl with some oil and salt before spreading them out on a pan to roast. If he's bothered by the lack of conversation, he doesn't show it, which is good because I learned to cook at my mother's hip and thus never developed a talent for talking while working. With the carrots roasting, I put Hayden on salad prep duty, rinsing and chopping Mom's freshly collected cucumbers, tomatoes, and onions, while I massage the kale with some oil and smoked salt. Mom makes her Alfredo sauce from scratch, and when the timer goes off, I pull the carrots out, stir them around the pan, drizzle them with some honey and spices, and pop them back in for a few more minutes. I'm so immersed in the process that it takes me a while to realize Mom is humming along to the music, another one of Cosmo's love songs on the playlist, Peggy All the Time. My chest twinges at the sound. Dad used to sing this as Angie All the Time. When I close my eyes at night, every time I'm down and out, if the sky is blue and bright, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about. It's Angie All the Time. Angie all over my mind. Tears unexpectedly spring to my eyes, not just for my mom, but for the woman Cosmo Sinclair wrote the ballad for Margaret Ives and the part of her story that broke an entire generation's heart.
Hey,
Hayden says, so quietly his voice is more of an impression than a sound, tucked beneath the music.
You okay?
When I let myself dream, or it all comes crashing down, if it all turns out all right, and at every pretty little sound, it's Peggy, Peggy on my mind, Peggy all the time. Onions, I say, the first outright lie I've ever told him, and he knows it. I lift the cutting board and swipe his neatly sliced veggies into the salad bowl with the kale. Soup's on, kids, Mom calls from the stove. Grab some forks and plates. It's serve yourself around here, Hayden. Hope you don't mind.
Not at all, he says. That's perfect for me.
His eyes connect with mine, and the moment of melancholy slips past, the kernel of something warm and giddy swelling in its place at the word perfect. I'm not sure why. It's not like he said I'm perfect, but all those little zaps of excitement must be melting my brain a little. Hayden on my mind, I think. Again, I wonder if the thought should terrify me, but there's no room for terror. There's just warm, golden light, the smell of freshly cracked pepper and almond soap, the soft pop of a cork Mom's pulling from a bottle of Cabernet, and a pair of pale brown eyes set into a thoughtful expression I can't believe I ever mistook for a glower. Perfect for me. I'm serious, Mom says. I hated him. You did not hate him, I argue with her over my own laughter. I did, she says, turning to Hayden, who's fighting a smile. I'm serious. First impressions are so meaningless. I hated him. She throws her hands up, then grabs her glass and takes another swig. Just to be clear, I tell Hayden, I've heard this story 90,000 times. She rolls her eyes. You're exaggerating, my girl. At 90,000 different dinner tables, I go on, and she's never once said she hated my father at first. She's always said she barely noticed him. That's because I didn't want to hurt his feelings, she says. Now he's gone, and I can admit I was not impressed. Mom! I cry, laughing a little from the shock of it. She so rarely talks about him, let alone acknowledges the humongous hole in this world where he should be. I had bad taste, and I didn't see what a gem he was, she says. I just thought he was so... She scrunches up her face as she finishes. Silly. I snort into my glass, narrowly avoiding inhaling wine straight into my lungs. Okay, well, that tracks, I admit. My dad could be silly. My mom, though she has her own sense of humor, is not.
What did you think was silly about him?
Hayden asks. She gives an exaggerated eye roll and pushes her empty plate back from the edge of the table.
God, what didn't I think was silly? I mean, we were living in a farming commune. Most of us took ourselves very seriously, you know? Alan was ridiculous. He was always singing, for one thing, and he couldn't carry a tune to save his life. Beyond that, he was terrible at remembering lyrics, so most of what he sang was nonsense anyway.
And what did he think about you?
Hayden asks, leaning in, engaged, naturally curious like any good interviewer should be. I catch myself beaming, waiting for the familiar beats. Her exuberance softens into a calm smile, her fingers resting at the base of her glass's stem. Oh, he says he did all of that singing and everything to try to get my attention, she says. But seeing as how he kept doing it until his dying day, I'm pretty confident all he really meant was he thought I was pretty. Here is where Dad would chime in, and so I do. Beautiful, smart, hardworking, with great taste in books. He just graduated from journalism school, she says, and I was taking a year off after undergrad, trying to figure out what to do. He'd see me reading in our downtime, so that was how he first struck up a conversation with me. Honestly, I thought he was so silly it hadn't occurred to me how much we'd have in common. The corners of her mouth tighten, her smile tilting toward woeful, and she says something I haven't heard before, something new to the story. He had this joy in him, this softness, and it took me a long time to realize that didn't make him dumb. In fact, he was a hell of a lot smarter than me. She's never been touchy, and so I've never been particularly touchy with her, but in that moment, for some reason, maybe it's the wine or the music or Hayden's comforting, stone-steady presence, I reach out and touch her forearm. Her smile tenses up a little, unconvincing, and she pats the back of my hand before pulling away to stand. Dessert, she says, moving the conversation on, and my heart flags in my chest. Sounds great, I say, but it comes out then. 22. I should have known you'd be out here, I say, crossing the garden to the stone bench where Hayden sits beneath the starlight.
Couldn't sleep?
He asks. I lower myself beside him. I'm so far off the schedule. Early to bed, early to rise, not really my thing.
And I'm just early to rise, he says.
In the distance, a barn owl hoots. Have you always been bad at sleeping? I ask.
Always,
he says. What is it? I ask. Afraid of the dark?
The way he glances at me, I can tell he's gauging whether I'm teasing him. I'm not.
No, not that.
He leans back, scanning the sky.
You know what I think it really is?
What? I ask.
I think I don't like people looking at me,
he says. Oh. I turn my gaze purposefully forward, across the dark garden, toward the lone lit bulb beside the door to the house.
Not like that.
He nudges my thigh with his eyes sweeping back to my face.
Not you.
Oh. A pleasant warmth vibrates through me.
I think,
he begins again.
I think as a kid, I felt so much pressure to act a certain way, be seen how my dad needed his sons to be seen. And I was bad at it, clumsy, rude. All day long, I think I sort of felt like I was flexing every muscle in my body or something. And then nighttime would roll around, and my family would be asleep, the whole world would be asleep, and...
He cocks his head to one side, his eyes sparking when they catch mine.
I started sneaking out when I was like 10.
And what exactly was there for a 10-year-old to do in the middle of the night in rural Indiana? I ask, letting myself lean against him, my head tipping to rest on his shoulder. He laughs a little, one soft rasp, and presses a kiss to the crown of my head that makes me feel volcanic, like lava is coursing down me.
Nothing,
he says.
Nothing at all. I just walk around our neighborhood listening to music on a Walkman my mom gave me, and absolutely everyone would be asleep, or at least inside with the lights off, and I just remember feeling light. No one was looking at me.
He seems a little bashful as he says,
I've always felt most myself when I'm alone.
It reminds me of something Margaret would say, of things she has said, and I wish I could tell him that. But I can't, not without breaking our most important rule. You want me to leave you to your alone time? I ask instead, and hurry to add, I won't take it personally, I promise.
Nah,
he says.
This is better.
He rearranges his arm across the back of the bench, and I move closer, his head resting against mine.
Does your mom know what you're working on?
I didn't break the NDA, I assure him.
No, it's not. That's not why I'm asking,
he says. The same owl hoots in the distance.
She hasn't asked you about it, about work, why you're here.
I shift uncomfortably. I already told you. She doesn't care about most of the things I write about.
But she cares about you,
he says.
That much is obvious.
Is it? I almost ask. But I know he's right. Mom's love has always been an action rather than words. Making that hideous quilt, teaching me how to bake my favorite peach cobbler and my favorite cast iron cornbread casserole, and serving one or the other every time I come home. I think... I'm not sure how to say this. I feel guilty saying it because I think it would break her heart to hear, even if it's true. I think she loves me because I'm her daughter, but I've never felt sure she loves me because I'm me. Does that make sense? He pulls away and ducks his head to peer into my eyes, his expression torqued.
I'm sure that's not true,
he says quietly. Maybe it doesn't matter, I say. Maybe the fact that she does love me is all that does. She made me who I am in so many ways, not just the skills she passed on, but the strength. When we were all scared shitless about Audrey's health, Mom was as steady as a metronome, day in and day out, working our land, making our meals, providing what we needed, driving my sister to and from doctor's appointments, and helping Dad homeschool us. She taught me to think of life not just in terms of how many executioner's blades were poised over our proverbial necks at any given time, but in terms of how we could use our time before that axe fell, or didn't. And a lot of the time, it didn't. Keep working, keep moving, keep hoping. He wraps his arms more tightly around me, pulls me in against his side, and tucks my head beneath his chin. I take a deep inhale of his almond soap and feel my chest loosen. My eyes flutter closed, his even breathing soothing me.
When I next open them, the sky is deep purple, the chickens just starting to move around, clucking in their enclosure. I pry myself away from Hayden, and he stirs awake, his eyes slitting open on a sleepy smile.
Hey,
I croak.
Hey,
he croaks back. Did my snoring keep you up? I ask. He runs a hand over his face, wiping the sleep from himself.
Weirdly, no.
We smile at each other a beat, a silent acknowledgement of how strange this all is, and at least for me, how strangely normal it feels. We're going to be covered in mosquito bites, I say.
Not me,
he teases scratchily.
I'm wearing pants.
Well, your arms have double the surface area of mine, so things will probably shake out pretty evenly. I fight off a yawn. Want some tea?
Tea sounds good.
He groans a little as he unfolds himself from the bench, giving me a hand to pull me upright and straight into a hug I wish I could wear like an almond-scented coat, morning, noon, and night.
I think my neck is stuck at an angle,
he murmurs against the side of mine. I reach up and knead the tight muscles there, and the way his groan travels through me makes every little hair on my arms and legs stand up like they're reaching toward him. Behind us, the door creaks open, and we lurch apart, but Mom hardly looks our way as she trudges toward the coop, a basket over her arm.
Anyone want to help me collect the eggs?
She calls to us, the mist seeming to nibble away at her voice like thousands of tiny fish pouncing on a piece of bread. I look to Hayden.
Tea can wait,
he tells me.
Yep,
I shout back to Mom as we start toward the coop.
Slept with Hayden,
I type to the group text, and when a flurry of exclamation points and what and tell me everything chimes in from Killian, Bianca, and Priya, respectively, I send a clarifying follow-up. As in, we fell asleep on a stone bench outside my mom's house. Priya replies with an unimpressed ellipsis. Killian writes, I still can't believe you took him to your mama's house. I've never even been there. I have, Bianca brags. Best spoon bread of my life. I dream about it sometimes. Rude, Killian says. Next time you're in Georgia, let me know, I tell him. It's an open invitation, I promise. Let's back up to you sleeping on a stone bench with a hot man like you're not two grown adults, Priya says. They're at her parents' house, Pri, Bianca says. What do you want them to do? Priya sends through a winky face. How are you guys? I ask. I miss you all.
Pretty good, Killian says. Except my editor is breathing down my ass about this profile on the team making the new ET miniseries.
I have never and I will never breathe down your ass, Bianca says. The piece needs work. Can you guys handle this privately? Priya says. I come here for the goss, not to feel like I'm at work.
I can literally see the top of your head poking out of your cubicle from here. Killian says.
Wait, you're at the office today?
Priya says, and then the messages go silent, probably as they reconvene in real life at the water cooler or office Nespresso. I go back into the kitchen to wash the rest of the breakfast dishes, then join Mom in the garden. I'd assumed Hayden was still out on his run, but he's actually back, drenched in sweat and working by her side. Hey, I call, trudging up. Could you use another set of hands?
Actually, I was about to shower,
Hayden says, pushing himself up and handing the spare gardening gloves over.
Lunch in about 2 hours?
Mom asks, without looking at either of us. Hayden's eyes and mine connect. He gives me a small nod. Sure, I say. And then we should head out. Mom nods, still digging with a trowel, focus buried in the dirt.
Nice kid, she says after a minute.
I ignore the flip-flop my stomach does and try to take up my post beside her. He's great. Really good writer, too. She sneaks a glance at me, then goes back to digging. Is she picking up on my crush, or is it something else? I've brought lots of friends here over the years, but never a boyfriend or love interest of any kind. In fact, imagining Theo here in my childhood home makes me feel like I'm 3 seconds from breaking into hives. I'd always been too afraid she'd disapprove. If she knew about my dynamic with Theo, I'm sure she would, and that would bother me in a way that her disapproval of Hayden, I'm fairly sure,
wouldn't. I'm still trying to figure out why when she says, "I read his book." I feel instantly like I might burst with pride, but I'd be lying if I didn't say there was a fair bit of jealousy mixed in there. It's amazing, isn't it? I liked it very much. That's high praise coming from her. "You want the hat?" she asks, pulling the drawstring loose under her chin. "You're going to get fried out here." "I'm wearing sunscreen," I promise her, but she ignores me and pops the wide brim over my face. After another minute or two of silence, she says, "He showed me that story you wrote about the child star."